This is the way that you build up a movement. Try to do your best to make an improvement. Do your jazz hands if you agree with me.
Turn off the kick. Let's have a commentary.
When you think about it,
woo! My good luck.
With the Danish police in the film. Let's get straight into the question of access, which I think is the most interesting thing, because activists are notoriously suspicious of mainstream media and tend to assume, probably with some justification, that they're going to be stitched up and portrayed as kooks and weirdos. So tell us about that.
Yeah, they thought they were
going to
be portrayed as kooks and weirdos. That was from the beginning the hardest thing. When I first started asking people in Plain Stupid and Climate Camp if I could film this kind of material, the run up to things and the aftermath, I mean, they flat out knows, like, absolutely, they wouldn't even consider it. I mean, effectively, what I was saying is, can I amass a whole body of material that could just, like, be used against you in court to bring a massive conspiracy case for everybody that was even remotely involved, didn't know, knew anything about it, and you can, you know, understand that they weren't very keen. And as you say, there's also a kind of healthy distrust of the media, because most of them have been, one point or another, pretty stitched up by somebody, you know, sort of taking an easy line and trying to report what they were doing. So I spent a lot of time talking to a lot of people, and particularly I was very lucky to get a lot of really good advice from a legal firm who represented a lot of activists, who really helped me work out ways that it could be done that was reasonably safe for people to participate in. For example, I knew that it was going to take quite a long time to film everything I wanted to film and then to edit the film, so I was able to promise people that I wouldn't release anything of any of the footage of them beforehand until all their court cases were finished. So that was kind of a big one. And all the material was kept in a safe house. There was an address not connected to me or any of them. I didn't keep any written logs of anything because the lawyer said, well, if the authorities find a written log, they'll just go, right, we want that tape, that tape, that tape, and that tape. All the tapes were labeled in this kind of encrypted fashion that it turned out later even I couldn't decode. So the first couple of months of post-production were really fun as we kind of just went, I would go, yeah, you know, I filmed that action. They're all in a box over there. So that, you know, it led to a lot of, but slowly and gradually I kind of gained people's trust, and I'd film with one group on an action and then I'd kind of be on another action and there would be similar people and they would kind of come to sort of get used to having me around. The other crucial thing was that I made it very clear to all the people that I was filming with that they would get to see essentially a rough cut of the film before I asked them to sign any release forms. Which allowed them to feel comfortable with having me around because they didn't want to have to be worried at any minute, did I catch them cutting through that fence or did I catch them giving one another, you know, because the big one was there are no leaders in these groups, right? But the police always want to find the leader and they want to catch the leader. So in that, you know, in that meeting that you see with everybody planning the action against RBS, if the people who are giving the legal briefing, this is what you do, or the people who are summing up what the meeting went before, well, that kind of looks like maybe they're the leader and they're putting other people up to this. And so all of that could have really been potentially quite sort of, quite dangerous in court for them.
So you were very careful to make sure that nothing in the film potentially incriminated anybody, and you made sure that everyone in the film was quite happy.
And we also had the lawyers that we're working with reviewed various cuts of the film and gave us feedback about what the legal risk might be, and also identified any of the individuals in the final cut that might potentially, even theoretically, have anything to worry about, and then we had long discussions with them about what that was and what risk they were taking. I didn't feel it was appropriate for us to take risks on their behalf. We really had to, you know, they had to go into it hand in hand. And, you know, that process was long and arduous and time-consuming. We had about 150 people on the list of people to wrangle and keep track of. And some of these people, live in, completely off-grid yurts in the countryside and don't check their email very often. And, the whole process really, you know, it took a very, very long time and a lot of effort, but that was really the only ethical way you could do it.
Were there any legal, were you worried anywhere that you were putting yourself on the wrong side of the law in sort of becoming part of the action?
Well, certainly during the year that I was filming actions on a really regular, because the other thing is that there's probably, for every action you see in the film, there's two or three that I went on that didn't make it in to the final cut. So, you know, I was going on actions really, really regularly and putting myself in a position where I could get arrested. And I think my primary concern was almost entirely for the safety of the people that I was filming, because I thought that it would just be, I would have been absolutely mortified if that footage had caused somebody to get a sentence that they wouldn't have gotten otherwise, or if somehow it had kind of come out. So I did become a bit paranoid with all of this cloak and dagger stuff. Every time I'd go on an action, I'd have to completely clean my flat of anything related to any of what I was doing and put it in a box and put it in the safe house and, you know, all this stuff. And it did become quite intense. I don't know that I ever really felt that I'd ever have. I did imagine potentially being in a long, protracted legal case about refusing to give them the footage, because that was a possibility. But I, you know, they were taking a much bigger risk than I was in allowing me to film them.
You've got no broadcaster attached to this film. Do you think that lots of broadcasters' attitudes would be that Emily's crossed the line and stopped being a journalist and become an activist and made a partisan campaigning film and not a documentary?
Yeah, pretty much. I come from broadcast TV. I have lots of, most of the films I've made in the past have been commissioned by broadcasters, and I assumed that I would get in, I'd get the access, I'd put some stuff down on tape, and I'd go in and I'd show it to him, and they'd go, "Oh my god, this is amazing access, of course I'll give you a commission, how much money do you want?" Didn't really work out that way. At the point where I actually had enough to show what kind of access I had, the reception was, you know, pretty lukewarm. There was a little bit of interest, but I was prepared to be quite cynical about the subject matter and kind of, you know, really kind of dig deep and show the dirt and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And I thought, well, this is ridiculous. These people are heroes, what they're doing. I'm not going to, you know, A, I'm not going to have gotten this far and gotten, you know, sort of gotten the project that far and then just completely sell that out just to get the money to make, you know, further my career in some way. And B, that was just the wrong film. It wasn't the film to be made with them. It wasn't, I thought, the appropriate way to tell their story. You know, I mean, yes, it's a sympathetic portrait, but I don't think it's kind of, everything I ever made is propaganda, so fuck it, I don't know.
Well, the kind of thing is, as a filmmaker with no agenda.
Well, that's the thing. This idea that you can, like, be objective is pretty absurd. Mm. We all have a point of view. We all come to it with a set of, you know, anybody that tries to tell you that they don't have politics is just delusional. So, you know, even this idea that kind of you can somehow gain a position of objectivity separate from your own personal kind of feeling, I think, you know, I think it's pretty suspect to begin with.
Have you had reaction from people in the industry which has been, well, this isn't quite what we want yet, or, you know, bother?
Not yet. They're, various people are looking at it. They're not talking, you know, they're not coming back to us really quickly.
I mean, presumably, I mean, in your experience, and probably most people's experience, a lot of broadcasters would be quite disappointed that nobody's in that job, you don't humiliate anybody, you don't find any backstory that somebody turns out to be a body count, or mentally ill, or have a diverse hobby, that they're all just very, very bright, intelligent, sensible, practical, dedicated people.
Yeah, God forbid, because somehow that doesn't make
good
TV.
Sure. And so you've got no broadcaster and no broadcast interest at the moment. Tell us about the funding of the film.
So at the point when I decided, right, we're going to have to go kind of all out independent on this, I was lucky enough to have found at that point Lauren Simpson, who's the producer of Stand Back. In fact, can we get Lauren and James, can you both come up here? Because I think it actually does sort of feel a bit weird going up here on
my own. Yeah, sure. Lauren was
You know, this is a project that I started on my own, and for the beginning kind of of stages of filming and getting people to agree, I was pretty much on my own. But then I found Lauren, somewhere in there, kind of, I think, around the climate camp, like Keith, and she agreed to join me as the producer on the project. And I couldn't have done it without her, really. There's absolutely no way that the project would come to, any kind of final fruition. And then James Ledbetter, who put himself forward as an editor for it, one slightly drunken night, and I held him to it. James was there alongside me all through over a year of post-production, going all through the ins and outs. And maybe, Lauren, you want to talk about the production model and the finance model a bit?
Much anti-capitalist production model. They wrote, maybe in profit, but that's fine.
Crap at capitalism.
Crap at capitalism, yeah. Basically, we started off with no money. We started a company, let's have a legal entity for the film, and just started trying to fundraise, writing lots of funding applications, lots unsuccessful to start with. And we decided to do a bit of crowdfunding, so we made our own website, which took 3 months to make, which we didn't quite realise it would take that long. And then we kind of launched a crowdfunding campaign, and in total we've raised about £15,000 through crowdfunding just through our website, £10 here and there. And the rest has really been foundation grants. CineReach have very kindly given us some money, Bertha Foundation via the National Film Television School, and then some private donations, little bits here and there. It looks like the BFI now will be supporting us with P&A money for the release of that, so that's very good. But yeah, it's basically been by hook or by crook, I think, and by pure determination.
And volunteers.
And volunteers, yes, and unpaid labour. That's been quite key.
Yeah.
I mean, we're all being exploited, so it's not...
Maybe say a bit about how many volunteers and like...
We've had over 100 volunteers working on the project, about 30 camera operators, maybe about 30 camera sequence editors who kind of parceled out for 300 hours of material. Lots and lots, we just literally couldn't have done it without the pure generosity of so many volunteers. So, yeah.
We've got a very big crowd, so I think there'll be quite a lot of questions, so perhaps we should open it up straight away. And I'm assuming that there will be questions. There's a question there, if you'll wait for the microphone.
Thank you very much for a great film. I have a question. I love lots of things about the film, but I wanted to ask a question about the thing that I'm a bit doubtful about, which is the title. And I realize there's probably some irony in there, but I was just wondering, considering the importance of the title, like not only for satellite TV and online viewing, but just for what people perceive from it. I was just wondering what process you went through to decide to use a Nike slogan as a title for an anti-capitalist film, and how much you thought about the irony of it coming back to bite you in the backside.
to begin with, it was chosen because I wanted a title that kind of encapsulated the spirit of the people that I was working with, and that really seemed to do it. And when I kind of thought of it, and my first thought was, oh, I can't do that because that phrase now belongs to Nike. And then I went, wait, fuck that. It's a phrase in the English language, and I'm going to choose a phrase in the English language as the title of the film. And, it's an act of conscious reappropriation, I think. We did consult the lawyers, and we did talk to them about what the risks were, and we were careful not to play with the Nike logo, and we were careful not to kind of besmirch their brand, bring it on. If they want to come and fight us, we're willing to fight over it. I think they'd probably lose ultimately, and we'd certainly win with all the publicity, so, that's kind of that, I think. James, do you want to say something to that?
If there's anyone from Nike in the audience, you know where we are.
Free trainers for everyone involved.
We did actually actually at one point have a, we went to visit someone at PR at Mother, and the guy that we were meeting with also worked for Nike on the Nike campaign, and he said, do you want me to make an introduction and see if they'll give you some money? And we were like,
Question there.
Hello. The tagline of the film is The Tale of Modern-Day Outlaws. And the picture that you were building was very much about people who are taking themselves outside of the law, very countercultural, and that seems like a very deliberate thing. And that's something that I've experienced when taking action on climate change. But there's, like, we perhaps over-egging the outlaw pudding. Like, there's lots of normal people with normal lives, and it's not an especially brave thing to do to take action. Are you at risk of sensationalising it by making the picture of people take action as outlaws and actually putting on people who aren't ready to do that?
I think James wants to answer this one.
No, because as Marina says in the film, like, it's important that we all become outlaws. And that's not a specialist thing. You know, as Marina says, you don't have to lock on, you don't have to glue on. Whatever you can do, you should do. But there are laws and there are decisions that are being made that are morally disgusting and should be stopped. And if we have to break the law to do that, then we are outlaws, and I heart outlaws.
It's a little bit tongue-in-cheek, the subtitle, you know, we wanted to kind of go, well, come on, are these people really criminals, are they outlaws, and to make that part of the dialogue around the film and to get people talking about whether they really thought that it was fair that they're criminalised to the extent that they are. I don't know how many of you will be aware of the kind of recent revelations about the amount of undercover policing that's gone on inside of groups like Climate Camp and related, and you know, the government seems to have been spending millions of pounds a year in order to embed full-time undercover policemen in with these groups. And, you know, really? Like, you know, they're not really that scary.
Did you ever have any suspicions about any? Because I mean, I know a number of activists in Leeds who were sort of mortified to find activists policemen in their ranks. And police women in their ranks. Did you have any suspicions about anything you came across?
No, not really.
None have been exposed so far.
None have been exposed. I mean, but that's the thing, because none of them are in London, and nobody's been uncovered in London or from that community. But it seems reasonably likely that there will be a couple, so we kind of expect that it'll come out. I hope it's nobody in the film.
I did rather than the Danish police were very much ahead of the game. There were times you thought they've second guessed this or they've got inside information. That might be being paranoid.
I think they were just doing with such a blanket policing of everything that there wasn't, you know, it wasn't. I mean, the things that people were doing were relatively open. Like the bike park project was being really quite openly organised, so it wasn't like it was a big secret to them. But what they were planning to do was ride bicycles up to a fence and then, like, take down a fence and meet with some people on the other side of the fence. So, you know, frankly, it was probably a little bit OTT because those weren't exactly weapons they were putting in that vehicle.
Did you find out whether they could legally do that, turn your camera off and take the confiscated bicycles and...
Well, since then, since all of that, the preemptive arrests have been ruled by a Danish court to be completely illegal. And it's really the law that the Danish government put in place specifically to police the protesters at the Copenhagen conference gave them such blanket powers that they didn't even know what they could do or not do. And in any given situation, they'd come in and they'd be kind of playing by the normal rules, and then suddenly their boss would go, no, you don't have to do that, you can just do whatever you want. And then it would change like every 5 minutes and stuff. You know, when Lauren was arrested, it's not entirely clear, I think, in the film, they wouldn't tell us even why she was being arrested. And that kind of is not really legal in most European democracies. And, you know, so there were a lot of things that they did that were clearly
completely out of order, and you know, pretty.
But the police act has been passed specifically to deal with protests against COVID.
Yeah, specifically for them.
Right.
But it's still in play.
It's still in place, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, more questions? I'm thinking those people being very subtle. It's not an auction, we need to see how it there's one there. I think there's one over there after that.
I'm really disappointed you didn't you weren't more explicit about this absolutely brilliant sleight of hand that you two played. I mean, it was just amazing. Suddenly, you know, changed the whole plot. Brilliant. Please explain.
Virus, okay. I don't like that thing at all. What happened? Well, we were quite careful about not having footage on me that was incriminating. I just actually dropped 6 tapes somewhere else. But there was an SD card in my pocket and I wasn't entirely sure what was on it. I made sure it was, you know, actually, when the police first started searching, I put it in my pants. And then when it was clear I was going to be taken to the police station, I was like, oh no, they wouldn't want to find it in my pants because that would look even worse. So I put it back in my pocket in time for when Emily was hugging me and she asked me, have you got any incriminating material? I was like, this is SD card in my pocket. And she said, oh, take your helmet off. I was like, okay. So it happened to be in my left pocket and the police were all there, so it was quite easy to just give it to her without the noticing. So. That was that. I mean, I don't know whether or not they would have actually done anything with it, or they probably would have suspected me a little bit more if they'd found what was on it, which is recce of a banner drop, I think.
No, it was the...
It was
a backroom secret meeting of all of the like bike club people. I knew what was on the card, so I was like, yeah. The weird part is, in the film, we had to like pause it just to make that sense. In my recollection, it took like 5 minutes that hug, you know? It was like this entire conversation. And then when we played it back on the tape, we were like, how did we do that so quickly? That was amazing. And we had left the tapes that they confiscated were 4 tapes that we had identified as having really innocuous material, and we'd left them out on a shelf saying to each other, if the police want to check up on what it is that we're filming, they can look at those tapes. But the activists that were there didn't know that that was the case, and man, were they fucking losing their shit when they saw tapes being confiscated. And the police did look at the tapes. They had to, like, they had to hold on for a while to get a machine that could play those kind of tapes and find a machine, and they did look at it, and then it was really kind of silly stuff, and then they were like, oh, these guys are the really lovely guys that they say they're doing.
Explain why I was actually arrested. It was a mistaken identity for someone they thought was a terrorist. They had a picture of somebody that they thought was a terrorist, but just because they had footage of her filming in the train station.
Which makes you a terrorist.
I don't know how that's evidence that I'm a terrorist, but nonetheless, they thought I was her, and they took me in to prove I wasn't there by looking at pictures of them. Person looking at me, and they figured it took 3 of them about an hour to figure out it wasn't me.
Well, in this country, they shoot because you've got a free mic. So, if anyone wants their films made, smuggle your SD card into the pocket of commissioning editors as they leave the festival. There's a question over there. I saw a hand raised, and this person's moved. Or if there's a hand, there. I'm going to wait for the mic.
I was here in November when you showed us this work in progress, and I've noticed that you've used quite different music, A. And B, the editing has somehow changed quite a lot.
Yeah, it's called process.
Can you explain what this process was?
Oh, yeah, you want to do that? The music actually isn't that different. Like, the two tracks that were in those edits actually ended up in the final film. I guess in terms of the actual process of the edit, I inherited 420 hours of footage, half of which was not labelled, as Emily said. I guess from when, I think by December we had like a 3-hour unwatchable film, and then we were very lucky to work with Kurt Engford,
who directed the recent Yes Men movie and edited some of Michael Moore's films. So he came over and beat the shit out of me for a week and helped us along quite a bit. And
I kept working with us
remotely from New York, which was great. And I think also we did, I guess, from kind of February onwards, we started presenting the film to the community. So we got a lot of feedback from people within the community about how things were being represented and what was missing and things like that. So that fed into that process really well. And then also the six main people in it, we were presenting to them and getting their feedback. And also I think we just got a bit more confident, I think, as we went along, probably, hopefully.
I think also the stuff that we showed, I mean, we kind of went out on a limb when we did the, I think actually the truth of the matter is when we agreed to do the work in progress, we thought we might actually have an actual work in progress by the time that we came around, and then it came around and we were like, anything. So we just chose the two bits that were the furthest along. One of them was a whole section on a storyline that eventually didn't even make it into the final cut. And that was actually one that I was really, really sad to see go, because I had always imagined the film opening with this climate rush action that was against the coal conference, which had failed. It was this really audacious plan. They had built this enormous sculpture and they were going to lock it onto the front of the conference, and the police were kind of there waiting for them when they turned up, not because they knew they were coming, but it was a high profile thing and it was, you know, quite likely to happen. And there was a scuffle with the police and then it was all over in sort of 3 seconds, and it was, you know, 3 minutes and it was done. And I thought it was great to show a failure as the beginning of the film. But that was, in the end, we couldn't include it for really boring reasons, like Marina was the main character in it, we had lots of other Marina material, we're trying to get the balance right, and it just had to go because it wasn't doing any other work, it wasn't doing the work that it needed. And again, Kurt was amazing in helping us to be really brutal about those things and to really kind of focus on character development and story development and get the balance right with all of that. As we tightened and tightened, more and more stuff... by the way, sorry. What? More and more stuff by the fell by the wayside, and it was sad. I think that was probably one of the hardest things about making the film, was watching pieces that I loved, go.
Are they in the DVD extras?
They are.
There will be DVD extras. There's quite a lot of DVD extras, so, you know, and those won't be available in any other way, and you'll have to buy the DVD in order to see them. That's the extent of our capitalism,
okay. Any more questions? There's a couple in that row, and then there's one here, and one back there. So we'll go those two, this one, then that one.
No, just to follow up on your next, we should see it. Two.
Sorry?
Second
movie,
a sequel.
Is there going to be a sequel, so maybe, and it doesn't, again, it would be great to see that, because of your skill as a director, so I'd like to see that.
Thank you. I am never doing a film like this ever again. It's brutal. It's taken years off my life. It was possibly one of the most difficult things I've ever done. And, you know, I'm immensely proud that we got to the end and there's a film, and I hope it's decent. But Well, officially I started filming, like the first material in the film was from April 2009, and I filmed for about a year, and then roughly another year of post-production, and then a bit more since then to kind of roll it out. But that's not really counting the probably that sort of 6 to 9 months that I spent trying to work out how to do it and convince people to do it and all of that. And, you know, filming completely independently with no financial support, all on my own. I didn't even own a camera. Every time I had to go on a shoot, I had to borrow a camera from somebody. And it was just pretty ridiculous. And I also, my son was 2.5 at the time, so it was like juggling, trying to like be something close to a responsible parent with also going and filming these actions where it would be like, I'd get a call and they'd go, there's an action, it's about the coal industry. You've got to be at such and such tube station at 2 o'clock tomorrow night, don't expect to be back for a couple of days. And that would be the extent of the information that I'd have, and I'd have to judge whether it was worth going on that one or not. You know, it was really, really hard work and really stressful, and you know, and that was just the shoot.
There was one in the middle of that photo as well.
Yes, in fact, you already answered my question, because it was how long did it take you to make the film. Also, another thing that I would like to say that is that your film can be not only an inspiration for the audience, but it can be an inspiration for filmmakers to make something in the future, for instance, about the student guards.
Yeah, I really hope that somebody makes a good film about the, you know, like, there's a short film in the festival about UK and Cut, which I'm afraid I haven't been able to see yet.
I've seen it's very good.
James seen it's very good. I'm really hoping that somebody will, like, you know, pick up that mantle and take and make a proper film about UK and Cut. I think they're amazing. And equally, I know there's a couple of projects in the work to make future projects around the student movements. And I think, you know, if they'd like a bit of advice, I'm up for it, but that's about the extent of what I can do with it.
Okay, there's a question here, and we've got about 3 more minutes, and then we're going to wrap it up. So,
what's the thank you. What's the law on when, in what circumstances, for what reasons, and what permission the police can take your footage and the purpose of the investigation?
Well, the question essentially is, you know, how can the police take it, under what grounds can they take it? And I thought there was going to be a really obvious and you know, straightforward answer to that when I first started talking to lawyers about, you know, what's the deal here. I thought it would be like, oh, well, this is the rules, and da da. Nah, you know, there's very little precedent. There's quite a lot of abuse, so they'll take it in the moment, even though they actually don't have the right to take it in the moment. People don't necessarily know that that's their right. What's the code?
Section 9 of the
Sorry, if you're a journalist and you are doing something like that, if you have a camera and you put a sticker on it on the back saying journalistic material covered under Section 9 of PAYS, they have to get a separate warrant to look at that material.
But what counts as a journalist is ambiguous, right? It doesn't count in Copenhagen, no matter what. I mean, I had a full press credentials, so it didn't seem to do me any good in Copenhagen. And also, there was no precedent in terms of if they had found a log sheet of what I've been filming and said, right, we want to have this tape, that tape, and that tape, there really was no precedent about what would happen in that case. And I remember when I first had a conversation with a lawyer and discovered that, and I really started to shit myself. This was like kind of relatively early on in the shooting, and I kind of thought, well, how do I protect people? What do I do? And I was, there was an executive producer was helping me at the time, loaning the equipment and that sort of stuff, and I called him up and I was like, oh, I don't know what to do. And it was really great because he said, well, if it happens, we'll just have to see what happens in court and I'll be there right behind you. And I was like, oh my God. It was scary, you know. Nobody really could say what was going to happen, and what the legal firm that I was, you know, talking a lot to, what they said was, don't let the police know the footage exists. If they don't know it exists, then it's going to be really hard for them to claim, because they have to be really specific. They can't just go on a fishing trip. That's what they said. They can't go on a fishing trip. They have to be able to name that meeting, that date, what you filmed, who was there, all that kind of stuff. So I just tried to kind of keep a low, you know, profile and not kind of let it be too obvious when I was doing the logs, all of that kind of stuff, and, you know, really do everything I possibly could and hope for the best. And, you know, luckily, they never came knocking on my door.
Well, we haven't had time, so get your plugs in very quickly.
I want to end on a personal note, because this is a film about changing the world, and when Emily and Lauren approached me to work on the film, I'd just come out of a psychiatric hospital, and I was living in a homeless hostel in Hackney, and my life had pretty much fallen apart, and they working on this project has pretty much saved my life, and I want to thank you both for being there for me through
what's been an amazing year and a difficult year, so thank you.
UK from 15th of July. So tell all your friends, look at our website justdoitfilm.com to find where screening near you. Lobby your local cinemas if they haven't got it already. And yeah, tweet about us at justdoitfilm.
And Facebook.
And Facebook, JDI.com.
Surprisingly useful. I don't understand how much it counts.
And tell human beings using your voice over. <That's true. laughs>